Hi, and welcome back to the Brew & Byte podcast, episode 18, The iPad, Form Follows Function. I'm your host, Craig, and if this is the first time you're joining us, welcome. And if you're a long-time listener, thanks for your support. Over the next hour, we discuss all the recent software updates from Apple and why they're important, as well as why a new Apple Watch may be useful for diabetic sufferers, and our feature as we delve into the best use for an iPad, as well as having time to answer your tech questions. Let's join the conversation. Let's firstly say hello to Alistair. How are you this evening?
I'm good. How's everyone?
Good, thank you. And next up, we'll say hello to Tina. How are you?
A happy and relieved person who's back with her phone. So that's good.
There's also a new shiny piece of tech. I think you're hiding away there in the corner.
I've got one of the M1 MacBook Airs. So that's good fun.
Our first convert.
I've given in.
And we'll also say hello to Martin. And did he order a purple iPhone?
Good evening, Craig. No, I didn't. I know purple is my colour, but I've got my iPhone red, so that'll do me for a while. I'm still looking. It's the Mac Mini I've decided the route to go for me. I want to refresh my monitors, so I decided that would be the best route.
Yeah, in terms of value for money, that makes sense, for sure.
I think so, yeah. If you look at the spec for spec, the iMac and the Mac Mini, the only major difference I can see is two extra ports on the iMac and a 24-inch monitor.
But are you going to go for the current lineup, or are you hanging on in the hope that there's going to be a super Mac Mini with a M1X or whatever it's going to be called?
The problem with all kit, as you know, the day you buy it, the following day you can buy something faster and cheaper. So I've gone beyond thinking like that. Now, I've got a 2018 MacBook Pro, which is struggling. I'm doing a lot of work on Photoshop, and the last few shows I've done, it's really struggled. It's taken a long time to render. I suppose in reality it's not a long time, but what I've seen the M1's capable of, I think that would be my next upgrade.
That's a very good point, because this week's first bit of news is that we finally have some idea of a shipping date for some of the new items that were released, in that we believe they're coming on the 21st.
Always believe John Lewis. They'll never knowingly lie to you or be undersold or whatever their thing is.
They were also the people that accidentally leaked that date, I think, on their homepage. And the actual date was also found in the code of Apple's own website. If you actually viewed the source code of the site, it had the 21st mentioned as the shipping date.
Is that for all the pre-orders? If you're looking to go and place an order tonight, I suppose you'll be looking at several weeks after that.
Yes. Some of the most popular models are almost at the end of June, I think the 30th of June. An interesting comment, I don't know if you came across this, was somebody told me today that the UK has the longest shipping dates of all the other countries. And I wondered if anyone had any ideas why that may be.
Is it anything to do with shipping through Europe? Because that's now more, I'm not going to mention the B word, but that's now more complicated than it used to be.
Rumour has it, it's about a 2-week difference. So we've got a longer wait for us Brits.
Isn't there a large distribution centre in, is it Netherlands or Belgium, as well as in Cork? The kit that I've had and bought online usually has come from the Netherlands. That's the posting or the forwarding point for items I've bought.
My understanding originally was that Apple, for previous launches, used to prioritise the UK for phones first, because we were one of the highest percentage of phones being sold, because we have 5 networks which sell the iPhone, when America at the time only had 2. So they used to prioritize us as being the highest selling phone. So this was around, I think, iPhone 7 time. And I'm not sure if that's changed, but it could be that if the kit is coming in, it's going to countries which would need it first. The only ones I can think of which would be in that category would be Italy or France. Because there, if you're coming in through the Mediterranean, you go to Italy, then you go to France first. Greece is not got a big Apple presence. If you look at the lineup of the people who are in the list when Apple will say, and it will be available in these countries, we're sort of in the first category. And it tends to be us, Ireland, and then it goes France, Germany, Belgium, and the rest of the continent.
I wonder if there'll be another issue with the colours again. Do you remember when the iMac came out in a range of 5 colours? Apple insisted that all the purchasers had to buy a certain number of the not-so-popular colours. They couldn't just pick and choose the green or the blue if that was what people were ordering. They had to take. Now we've got seven colours in the new iMac range. Are they going to have to ship all seven colours, or have they already decided which is going to be the more popular? And I presume that when they ship them from the manufacturing point, they all come out in, as Alistair's favourite term, the Goldilocks format. And then at the distribution centre, there's a stream taken away for actual conversion to individual orders, or if you've put in a special requirement for additional memory or storage. And that they're taken out at that point. So the distribution cycle now with seven colours must make it harder as well.
I think they do some form of judgment over what is likely to be popular, because obviously having just done an order and I did click and collect, which I have to say, thank you Stratford Express, was very safe. But I obviously got a popular model.
So they've already had 20 years of working out which colour devices people like. So we only have to look back at the iPhone 5C when that came out in colour, and they found out which colours work best in which countries. And it transpired that, what was it, the colour which was least picked up, I think, was the yellow one. And then they said certain countries had a real colour which they considered their national colour. And so they discovered that certain colours were setting up in certain countries. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if certain countries pick up certain colours, but other ones don't. So they would have already pre-selected certain countries to get it. If I remember correctly, when the iMac version B came out, which is the colour ones, the orange and the red were the highest demand. But the ones that most people got given were green and purple, because they were the ones that people didn't want. And the one which was the hardest to get out of all of them, can you remember?
No, go on.
There was one called Blue Labrador, and Blue Labrador was the one with the daisies on it. It was impossible to order. You had to have, it was a limited edition, and they were only, I think, 100,000 produced. And you had to know someone, or you had to put a pre-request in the day they were announced at the Apple event. Because we tried to order one for our university because it had a particular upgraded spec. We were told they're already sold out.
The other piece of news this week is the security aspect and privacy subject fell when we saw the release of 14.5. Have any of you noticed any difference since you've installed it on anything?
Music's changed slightly. It gave me a whole list of things that it's slightly different on there. But I haven't actually seen any difference, but it's told me it's put a few new features in.
Because they also released 14.5.1, which, if you haven't got it, I'd recommend that you did, because there were a number of security issues. One being a flaw in WebKit, which is actually the mechanism that's built onto Safari. So that's an important one. I don't know if Alistair's got some more.
It's good to see that Apple's bug bounty program is working, because they announce it and then Apple released the fix, I think it's what, 30 days after?
This time was really quick. It might even be a record in that that's the quickest next update that they've pushed out, just 7 days after the previous one.
I think the fastest one previously was 2 hours, and that was something like OS 8 or something.
The other exciting thing is, did any of you download 14.6? So the beta, we've seen one rather unusual add-on. So now you can actually apply an emoji image to the name of your AirTag instead of it just being a name. So if you've had an emoji engraved on your AirTag, you can now match it in the software, because that feature is not currently available. There was also some issues around the privacy settings. I don't know, did any of you see the privacy option grayed out on any of your devices? People were finding it difficult to turn off the app tracking. That has been changed. If you haven't looked, it's worth having a look, because it's not evident that it may not have been active on your phone. So pop into settings to see if it's in there. And it should, by default, be turned on with a little green icon. But if it is grayed out, it's worth trying to reset that, because you may not even find that you can turn it on and off. It's actually a bug that's been grayed out. Quite a number of customers have seen that. Hopefully 14.6 that's coming at some point in the future resolves that for a lot of people. The other big change is how we actually get iOS updates. So now you can actually download a software update over the mobile phone network, which was never an option before. And if you see an update pop up in the settings, you can choose to install now or delay it until you've gone and connected to a Wi-Fi network.
I must admit, the upgrade cycle for most products seems to work relatively well. It does it automatically at night. The phone tells me it's going to update when it's in a power supply. My watch says, okay, next time it's connected at 50%, it will connect through the phone to do its update. So background process, automatic updates, seems to work for me personally relatively well. I can't say I've had too many issues about problems afterwards. And I think, especially with the amount of software piracy that's going on and spam and everything else, I think staying automatically updated to me makes sense. I know some people don't like to have the updates, and I can't recall a time when an update actually did any real harm to any of the machines I was working. A couple of minor issues with compatibility with third-party product, but normally, it, as the old saying goes, it just works.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got the whole thing at the moment with Epic and Apple arguing in court, and I think one of the things concerns me is whether or not we lose the ability with the sandboxing, because as someone who doesn't, I don't do anything, you know, I used to be a teacher, so I always had students that said that they could hack my phone so that I could do other stuff that wasn't allowed. And I was always, well, win some, lose some. Maybe I don't have that much control, but because of the sandboxing, I at least feel like my phone is mostly safe. So I'm happy to stay within the app ecosystem, because although I've given up some control, I've gained a lot more safety. And what is interesting will be what things like Facebook do, because I think in America they're looking at something like 94% of people have opted out of tracking.
That's actually a really good point. This kind of goes off topic, but in talking with other podcast producers and some other software developers, they are coming up against a revenue stream issue in that they've actually lost money from advertising agencies because the information is no longer going to be there. They can't physically target a customer as such as they could before. So it's kind of now we're seeing what's going to go potentially the other way in terms of investment into the industry. But that's a whole other topic. That's not an easy one to answer in 5 minutes. But the one exciting thing is we now have an official WWDC countdown. And can Martin tell us how many days are left on Apple's countdown until the big day?
We were talking about the actual image that you see is, I'm sure, to take on Craig's loving picture as he gazed into his Apple laptop as he opened it up at the show. Here we see, it's obviously not an emoji of Craig Federici, but there is a lot of love in those eyes looking, staring into that screen. We have 28 days, 21 hours, 17 minutes and 24, 23, 22 seconds to go. I'm very much hoping that we will be having one of our LMUG special events on the night to have a look at the show as it happens, and then have a chat and a discussion about the major features of it afterwards. So, watch out on the website and on our soundbite to our members and all those other people listening for details of that special LMUG event night.
Now, are we going to discuss the rumour mill? So this big rumour for this week was, is the Apple Watch going to receive a glucose monitoring feature? Reason being is that supposedly Apple have made lots of investments in a UK startup company that has a significant relationship with blood sugar monitoring functions, and will we see it before 2022?
As a diabetes sufferer, I have to do the stick test, you know, a couple of times a day to monitor my levels. There are systems out there you can buy now which are like stick-on patches, which will monitor the glucose levels on an instant basis. But some of them can be quite expensive. They're £35-40 a month for a month's kit. The fact that you could have a watch that could keep an eye on that would be, for me, an absolute first reason to buy the new phone and update. And I think that the fact that you've got a mobile tracking system. Again, I suppose that the app will not only warn you if there's a problem, but if you happen to go into shock and have passed out, if the phone can then issue a warning or bleep or telephone an emergency number. There's all manner of exciting items that would open up.
If they can crack the accuracy, that would be amazing, because diabetes in this country is a big deal. And if you don't keep your glucose levels steady, there are so many things that come from that. And with an aging population, it would be a big deal, really. I do think accuracy is going to be key, though, because I'll be honest, when I know I'm unfit, but I look at my heart rate according to my watch and I'm thinking it's not beating that fast. You know, I know I'm unfit, but my chest would actually be coming out of my chest if it was that bad.
If it was that super accurate, I could look at it and say, okay, am I going to go up to the bar now and have that extra pint of Guinness or not? It could be, yeah, extremely useful.
The other one, which will be interesting, which they've already sort of highlighted, and I'm not sure if anyone's looked at the technicality of this, but most of these rely on you being hydrated. So if you're in a warmer climate, you'll dehydrate quicker. And so this one of the apps what may say you need to hydrate before we can give you an accurate representation. So you may find that people will have to drink more water as a result of it, because it says we can't give an accurate reading at the moment. Please drink a glass of water and then check in 5 minutes and we'll be able to confirm it. The way in which it sends electricity through your body, if you're dehydrated, gives a wrong reading or false positive. And so it may, in some respects, extend some people's lives because they're pushing out the toxins. So this may be a whole new range of things which may be happening as a result of it.
Well, it could shorten their lives, because it'd be Martin thinking hydration equals Guinness. It's made me think of a really rubbish app I think I first bought when I first got an iPhone. You know, you could get, is it a pint of beer and pretend to drink it?
We all bought that one along with the candle. Do you remember? We all bought the candle, the burning candle. So we had a little nightlight of a candle burning. Yes. Yeah.
I remember that well.
Innocent days.
Okay, then who has still got either of those two apps on their phone?
I haven't, but I didn't take it off. I just think that it just was never upgraded, and therefore it's one of those apps that can't operate on the latest system.
Okay, let's move on to our main topic, which for once is something different to a Mac, or is it even closer to a Mac, as you may think now, is the subject of the iPad. And Apple is well known for its industrial design. Does form really follow function? My quiz question to the panel tonight will be, does anybody know when the first iPad was released?
Well, because the first iPhone was 2007, so I'd say 2010,
2014, I'd say.
Alistair is closest. It was the 3rd of April 2010. But we thought we would talk about that tonight, because if you did see Apple's big pile of cash, you may have also spotted that just in iPad sales, it was worth $7.8 billion, which is actually up 79% on the previous year. I know maybe the pandemic has a lot to answer for in terms of our use of tech and what we're doing from home, but that's quite an astounding figure to jump by. My first question of this evening was people's first experiences of their iPads, and most importantly, has your use of your iPad changed since you first got it?
I'll take a stab at that one. When I first had the first iPad, I had was an iPad Pro, the original one. And I think, like most, I used it for watching stuff, doing mail, the kind of stuff that you could easily do touching the screen, tapping the screen. But as the machine has got better and the apps have improved, I don't use my laptop as much out and about as I used to. And I use my iPad for doing things, creative things now, where one of my... I'm going to preempt your favorite app question here. I use an app like Magic Plan, which I use for site surveys. The big thing for me now with that is I can use that to measure a room, and then I can use that and download that to my main 3D drawing program. The use of the pencil there on the iPad is brilliant, that you can alter and adapt and change things. Literally, you're working almost like a piece of paper. So that has changed in how much I actually use an iPad for now. Not just doing emails and watching some YouTube or a film. And the new one, I'd like to upgrade, because it has the LiDAR sensor on it. And in that case, all I have to do now with this Magic Plan app is that I just literally stand in the middle of the room and I can work my way around and it will measure each wall and do the whole basic outline of the building that I want straight into the system, which is hugely time consuming. And, you know, when you're going around trying to measure every individual nook and cranny, to be able to do that. And again, with the iPad, you can use your camera, you can take photographs of details. So for me, it's an incredibly useful tool out on site where I do a lot of my work.
Perfect. So for me, my example, I would say that it's completely changed in that, yes, I did have the original iPad when it first came out. And at that point, an app store didn't exist, so we couldn't install any other extra apps. I also think how I use the actual iPad has changed. So maybe generations 1 to 3, it was more of an entertainment, like consumer device, in that I would watch lots of TV or I would surf the internet on it. But now we've got the iPad Pro range and they're getting far more advanced. I think a lot of that is down to the software more than anything. I don't know about you, but I seem to find that now the apps that I've got installed on the iPad mirror the ones that are on the Mac, and they're even more closer than they were before. I don't think I would have ever had Photoshop or Procreate or a form of drawing program, as you mentioned there, Martin. I think a lot of the progress has been made from the software side of things. I don't know if Alistair has a similar opinion or not.
From what I've seen, that some of the apps you can now get are quite specialized, especially the drawing apps. I agree with Martin that the camera side has really picked up since the very first iPads came out. My iPad is still an iPad 3, so I have it pretty much as a sort of just looking at films or checking up the internet or carrying something around to look at photos with. So it was like a picture frame. Because what I found is I ended up carrying most of the stuff I needed on my iPhone. So my iPhone has turned into a sort of a smaller iPad, so I do a lot on that. But then again, I do travel with a MacBook Pro pretty much all the time, so I'm always with a bigger device when I'm traveling. But what I have noticed is everyone from using the iPad as their only camera, and you'll see it when you go to some historic monuments and you see someone going around with a giant iPad, when you realize that the iPad they're using is nothing better than an iPad 2, because it's got square edges, and you think, hang on, that's iPad 2. Then the other thing I've noticed is that some people have it as the only computer they use. Everything is on the iPad, and they have completely sold off all their computers, and this is their sole device. So it was quite so impressive how much things have changed.
So I've got an iPad Pro in 2018. I'm not getting the most out of it because I'm still at the, I consume things on it rather than use it to create. So I watch things, I read things. I've got a little bit more sophisticated. So there are some books, for instance, that I might buy Kindle and I'll read it on my iPad because it's got colour. The irony is, the thing, it did save my bacon during the first lockdown because an Apple Pencil and PowerPoint and Teams meant that I was actually using it to teach online. So I can see a time that I might move to using an iPad, especially when you start getting the power, because you're right, it could be your only computer. With a keyboard, and they sort the connectivity out for me, it could probably be it.
I find that I'm in the kind of quandary because two of the bits of software I use extensively, ArchiCAD and Final Cut Pro, are not available on the iPad. So that's why I have the laptop to do that kind of work. So the upgrade process I'm going through this year will be to upgrade the laptop. But I think now that the iPad Pro is to the extent of power and availability of programs, that other than the two programs I don't need on the iPad, that could replace all my other computing needs, especially with the magic keyboard, everything else. It is in effect a mini laptop. How long will it be before iOS and macOS merge, so we have one operating system?
So there's some interesting ideas on that. One of the problems one of my clients faces is that they have, at any given time, anywhere between 50 and 150 tabs open in any browser, whether that be Safari or whether that be Firefox. And the biggest problem you have is when you have all those tabs open, it just eats away at all your memory. And Time Machine has a hard time trying to keep up with it. And effectively, it's what an iPad is excellent at. But looking at a small screen compared to a 24-inch iMac, there is a big difference. But there are a number of excellent systems for saving memory and saving power on an iPad. And it wouldn't surprise me if we have a sort of integration system whereby you could offload or hand over, you know, I would like these tabs to be put in stasis, and then you just drag it over to the iPad, and the iPad acts as almost like a mini hard drive and holds them for you. And then you slide them back again, a bit like a more advanced version of Handoff. And that way you're not trying to get the iPad and the iMac to be the same device. They're both excellent at doing different systems.
My question was going to be, is the iPad better? And if so, why?
What, than a MacBook or a...
Than a standard mobile device in terms of it being maybe a MacBook, maybe a MacBook Pro, or even, is it a desktop replacement?
For me, one of the things I like about a laptop is typing. And I suppose, and I prefer that at the moment on a laptop. You could ask, is that because I haven't got a keyboard for my iPad?
I have my, we're talking now, my MacBook Pro is up on a stand, help with airflow, and I use a wireless keyboard. And I can also use that with my iPad if I need to, or I have the fold-up iPad keypad as well. I think the difference was when I got my iPad, I had an early MacBook Pro, which only had 3 hours of battery life, whereas the iPad Pro would go all day on one charge. So you could sling it down on the chair beside you, on the couch, wherever you were working, pick it up, turn it on, do it, put it away. The MacBook Pro at the time didn't have that facility. I know the new ones now, they last all day. So that was why I got the iPad, because it gave me that flexibility that not having to constantly keep the MacBook Pro charged up or run out of charge at crucial times with it. Otherwise, you have to carry other chargers and battery packs and all that kind of stuff. So the iPad, from that point of view, all day life, was very useful. You could just pick it up, off you go.
I also think that in coming back to the portability aspect of it, is that this is something where the internet is always on. It's not like a MacBook that you have to go and find a Wi-Fi connection. If you've got a 3G or even a 5G iPad, you can always have some form of connection back to the internet. So if you need to pull a piece of data off of iCloud, it's going to be there. It's less hassle. That's my argument of potentially why it could be better, especially if you're in a job where you're mobile all the time.
Well, I surprised you. I never got the cellular version. I always got the Wi-Fi version, because with my iPhone, it was easier to tether it to the iPhone and use it that way. So I didn't see the need to have a separate second account just for the iPad, because invariably, you know, my phone was with me. Again, going back to when the iPads came out, the phones were smaller. You couldn't really do big spreadsheets on them or anything like that. The phones weren't as capable as they are today.
That leads nicely onto one other major feature that might make the iPad better, is in terms of maintenance. So our tech expert, Alistair, may pick me up on this one, but I think iPads are far easier to manage and look after, because there's no failure of butterfly keyboards. There's no necessarily major speaker problems in terms of spilling water over the top of your MacBook Pro. There's just a much lower failure rate in terms of the technology that's in it. But I'm sure Alistair's going to argue his case on this one.
The main difference you would have is the iPad has got no fan. So you would say, okay, up until the M series chips, that was a big issue because Intel required fans to keep them cool. And up until very recently, you liked to have a laptop because you could change the hard drive, or you could change the RAM, you could upgrade it, so it was still cost effective. But now, with everything being all on one chip and the whole motherboard unoperable, it does pose that question of what can you do with your Mac versus your laptop. But the main thing I would say is that with a laptop, when you travel, you've got it covered. The top of the screen covers the keyboard and the screen. With an iPad, it's open. So you would have to buy a case to cover the screen. Second one is that the vast majority of iPads I see stay in people's homes. Occasionally you see them traveling, but I see a damn sight more people, especially in airports or going around the place dealing with that. What they do carry with them is their phone and their Kindle, it's going to be a difference of what people are familiar with. I know a lot of people use the iPads as a secondary device or to play a particular type of music or to watch something because it's got better clarity of picture or it's lighter for traveling on holiday with, or they watch it for when they're going on a long haul plane. That makes sense. But if you're looking at a multitasking device and someone has given you a USB stick with your files on it, with your Mac or with your iPad, you'll have to convert it. But the software at the moment is still holding up the iPad because the amount of times I go onto websites and I'm loading it on my phone and it won't work and I have to go onto a computer because the website is old-fashioned and doesn't recognize the iPads today. So from a purely technical point of view, until they resolve a number of software issues or hardware issues, we're always going to have problems. But we get the gap is closing, I would admit that.
Is it a generational thing, do you think, guys? Are older people like ourselves more used to laptops, keyboards, that kind of form factor? Whereas a lot of younger people who have grown up with touchscreen, who are not familiar with old-fashioned clacky keyboards, they haven't got that inbuilt muscle memory about using an old-fashioned typewriter. The younger people are more used to using touchscreens, flat screens, and that kind of usage than people who've, you know, I've been using keyboards for, 50-odd years now. And it's almost built into me that I like a good, solid keyboard that responds to me tapping and typing. I do find a touchscreen a little bit more difficult to use.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I can remember we had a meeting and we was talking to a member who was really excited about the idea that you could use Scribble and write words in Google, for instance, in a search. You know, you could use it on Safari and do searches. I did it once just because I could. And then I went back to just typing in it. And that's on an iPad because I'm just it just felt unnatural. Should I accept the fact that I'm not young and with it and I'm still clinging on desperately, so forget that. Right, I think I find inputting data easier with a keyboard.
How about you, Craig? You're obviously younger than us.
That's actually a really good question. So if I know I've got a lot to write, I will sit at a keyboard, but I may sit at a keyboard that's attached to an iPad.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Do you actually use the keyboard on the iPad? Do you use the glass touchscreen for typing? That I find it slows me down. I don't feel as comfortable using it. I'd rather, that's why I've got the keyboard cover for the iPad. And I tend to use that all the time. As I said, I don't feel as comfortable typing onto a glass screen as I do to a keyboard.
See, now I would type a lot on my iPhone because of the size of it. And yes, maybe my fat thumbs type everything, but I wouldn't use an iPad screen to type with. It's interesting. I would go back to a keyboard in that respect.
I was just thinking about this. When I've traveled to other parts of the world whereby phone technology is like hugely popular. So when I was going around Japan, I didn't actually see that many people carrying iPads, or you'd see them carrying phones, yeah, all the time. They're very common and very easy to get hold of, but they're like a complete different range of phones than we have here. But the main thing is that their keyboards are Western keyboards, and a Japanese keyboard is over 200 keys. Most of it is either done by speech, so you send someone like a voice message, or you learn to type Western. Or you send pictures, which is where the emoji comes from. And so it's a sort of cultural difference as well. And one of the things I noticed was that laptops are still big. I went to the Apple store in Tokyo, and laptops are still very popular there because it's the formal thinking of it. When you have a laptop, it's a serious option. With a phone, it's something you carry with you. It's the convenience. And I remember reading, stop trying to get every device to cater for every single individual. Some people prefer to have a device which has just turn it on and it works.
You're moving into an area there. We have to do workplace assessments for people working in offices. And there, an iPad is totally inappropriate. You can't get the screen at the right height. It doesn't work in there. If you're going to be sitting at a PC for 8 hours in a day, an iPad or a plate or a tablet or anything like that is a very difficult concept to work into workplace assessment for safe seating and safe use. So that's why so many people still have the old-fashioned PC on their desk, because that can be configured and made to work.
And also in some situations, the other issue about iPads is they're personal devices, and sometimes computers aren't personal devices. They're devices that lots of different people use. And so you have accounts and you sign into your account.
Ooh, there's the multi-user question coming right there.
Yeah, and so at the moment, iPads, multi-user is an interesting area.
I think the biggest problem, though, is that if you're trying to lay stuff out, if you are, let's say you're writing a document and you've got the first draft and the second draft side by side on the computer, you can arrange them right naturally, right? And you can do it. But as soon as you put that keyboard on, you've lost some of your screen size. And so then you have to go to an external keyboard, which you have as part of your case, in order to get that screen space back so you could do side by side comparison. And it's the other factor is if you look at it, you're comparing a 12-inch iPad or 9-inch iPad to a 24-inch monitor. And over time, your eyes will, no matter what you try, it's very hard trying to look at that small screen, even though it's got great resolution, whereas a big monitor at the right height is just easier to read off.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Alistair, in the fact that the iPad is a portable computer, whereas your Mac Mini or your iMac or whatever isn't. And I think they're designed and aimed at two totally different markets. There is some crossover between them, and yes, you can use an iPad as a iMac in a lot of situations, but there's benefits to either one. But my concern is how close is the iPad getting to a laptop? That's where the real discussion arises. Is it going to replace a laptop? Are we going to lose the MacBook Pros and the MacBook Airs?
I reckon you'll always have the MacBook Pros, but the MacBook Airs could disappear and the MacBooks could disappear. Because if you look at it, they're very competitive at the moment on price. Whereas if we go on the old Steve Jobs model of have the Pro line and the consumer line, you could do that. But what they discovered, and the thing that's keeping it alive from what I understand, is two areas. One, in America, there's this system whereby schools have to give a computer to their pupils going for the year in order to comply with this online computer thing, which is a big thing in America. They tried doing it with iPads, but they can't get all the book formats to appear on iPads because Apple only has iBooks, whereas you need to go onto certain websites and read books, or if it's not Pearson, it's another group, and try to look at it that way. The second thing is that the corporate use like to have the ability to lock out certain actions from your computer. They have the administrator account and the one which they give the person who's now got that computer account. And when someone moves department, they take off the profile and give it to someone else. With an iPad, you have to wipe everything and put it back on again. It's not that simple. The other thing we've discovered is, would the iPad disappear completely and would we just end up with a merged iPad iPhone? So that's always been a discussion as well.
From a technical standpoint, the only thing that's really stopping the iPad becoming a full integrated solution of its own and discounting MacBooks and MacBook Pros is the fact that you cannot have more than one audio interface, which is an absolute nightmare. If you're doing anything with audio, you have to have a secondary device that's actually physically recording audio. A MacBook Pro can happily do it, but an iPad doesn't have a chance.
When I think they'll bring iOS closer to macOS, and eventually they will. I think there'll be a hybrid of the two, so that apps that run on either an iMac can run on an iPad. I know they're getting towards it now. A lot of the apps are transferable, but the operating system, I think, will at some point merge. Having what they've got now, five different operating systems, I think is going down. Surprises me for Apple, because they don't like that kind of diversification. They prefer things to be simple, straight on with, OS X, for example. So I think there is an issue there that, especially now with the A14 chip being so similar to the M1 chip, and I think that divergence will disappear in the next round. I think we won't see, the M1X or the M2 will also power the phones.
So has anyone used the Microsoft equivalent? So Microsoft Surface is the same operating system as you have on the, so it's Windows 10, and then you've got the Windows 10 Surface laptops, and then you've got the Windows 10, which you can put on there when you use Windows machines. The problem is it didn't work on the phone. Remember Windows phones were around for a long time, and a lot of people liked them because it was very simple and it worked very well. But it was a very different animal from the Surface. They were very different. They were two separate operating systems, but based upon the same idea. The vast majority of the public couldn't get on with Windows phones. And Surfaces are still very good machines. They're excellent. They go around and people have them. But what do you see in the coffee shops? What do you see in the films? What do you see generally going around the high street? You don't see Microsoft Surfaces. Surfaces are normally for business users who want something small, elegant, and powerful, which runs Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. Fine, that's excellent. But the biggest problem they ran up against was internal memory, because they never put good enough, the original ones didn't have big enough memory in them, if you remember.
You mentioned earlier on, Alistair, that a Surface, you can have an admin account on it, which businesses like. And that's the big difference between that and iPad Pro. For all the reasons you said about security, access for companies, they want to make sure they know what you're putting on that machine. So a Surface Pro can have an admin account on it to lock out the chances of you putting some nefarious software on it.
Well, I've got one question to ask you all. Do you think we're overthinking this, and actually the business market is not relevant for the iPad, and the iPad should only really be catering for the consumer market, and the new M-series MacBook Airs are for the business side?
I think the iPad Pro is targeted at the designer market, isn't it? Apple love the high-end marketing of architects using it and designers using it, fashion designers, all those sort of people. If you look at the adverts they do, they're not too many builders in there, and there's not too many people who look after accounts. There's still no good accounting software for the Mac. It's never been an area they've targeted at all. It's not, because it's too boring. It's not sort of stylized, nice sort of people they want using their iPads.
Yeah, from a creativity standpoint, you're definitely right on that one, for sure. Because even I think now, the amount of drawing apps, or in particular, I think back now when I was taught in a design school, Wacom tablets were a huge thing. This is before the days where you could physically see what you're drawing on the actual surface of it. But now they're getting replaced by iPads and iPad Pros. And it's when you start looking at industry pieces of software. So I did an update recently on Procreate. And the interesting thing on Procreate's main page of their website is that this app is used by Disney. This app is used by LucasArts. All of their creation content is coming from an iPad. It's not a Wacom drawing tablet as such anymore. It's completely changed the market.
Well, look at trying to do, if you're trying to do work in Photoshop or any of the photo manipulation apps, using a pencil on an iPad as opposed to a mouse on a big screen is so much easier. It's much more creative, I think, if you're using a pencil. Like you mentioned, Tina, when I'm doing out and about on sites and stuff like that, the advantage of having a pencil to be able to make a note or an annotation on the screen for a drawing that I've just put in, and I come across, oh, there's a pipe in here that I need to remember. Being able to add that with a pencil very quickly is so much easier. Or even taking a picture of something. I can take a picture of a particular issue, corner, project, whatever I want to do, and now I can write on the screen with my pencil, draw an arrow to it, and make notes for myself that when I'm back in the office, oh, yeah, I remember that gas pipe sticking out of the wall. Brilliant. That, for me, it works so well. Being able to tie the drawing, the photograph, and maybe a quick scribble note is just invaluable.
Oh, that's going to throw in the question, is if you had to choose one iPad app, what would it be? What would you say is your favourite?
I use an app called Magic Plan, which for me is absolutely brilliant. It helps me with all my survey work, from creating the actual model that we're going to be working on, to making photographs, to making notes, to typing in bits and pieces. I can link it. It's secured over the internet. So if I lost the pad on the way back to the office, all that work I've done is still stored on the cloud, and I can just download it when I get back to my machine. I can import all that information into my big flashy ARCHICAD package. Yeah, that app is brilliant.
And for that app, Martin, does it work in terms of having layers, and does major programs like Photoshop pick up those?
Surprisingly, there is a 3D element to it. The latest version has now got 3D, but that gets much more difficult importing into the 3D. You've got to have exactly the right format to do that in. As for photos, no, they're not layered, so it doesn't help in that sense. But the resolution of the camera is still pretty good that you could take that into Photoshop and start working on it if you needed to.
I feel bad now because Martin's done something really clever and mine's not going to be clever at all. And I've been thinking about it. Messenger. And the reason I like Messenger is, hard as it is to believe, I have friends that don't have iPads or iPhones. And yeah, and I still speak to them. Messenger's cross, you know, platform. And okay, I've got friends that don't use Facebook for various reasons. So then I use Teams. But it just means that I can see and speak to friends. I can remember that was like the big excitement, you know, when they talked about what was going to happen in the future, apart from the fact that they said that people were only going to work 2 days a week because there wouldn't be enough work, you know, for everyone to do a full week. I'm still disappointed. And paperless office, that was the other one. But video calls are just like, when you stop to think about it, amazing, especially in this last year, the idea that you can see people, talk to people. A messenger for me means that they don't have to have an iPhone. I still prefer FaceTime, I'll be honest, but Messenger's pretty good for people that are on Facebook that I want to speak to, so like that.
Alistair, do you have a favourite?
So this one's going to sound a bit peculiar, but a lot of the people I teach iPads to, and the app which they get the iPad for, is mail. It's their only way they send and receive mail, because it's something they can carry around with them. And it's the only thing I ever get asked for is, how can I use mail more effectively? Or what does this mean? Or how do I send an attachment with this? Or how can I use it? And it may sound really simplistic, but if all you really want is a device that sends email or just receives email, an iPad is brilliant, because you don't need any additional software to read the attachments. One of your relatives has sent you a document, you can read it. And you can go, thank you for it. You don't have to reply to it. And if you need to do anything, it just works. You know, click on this link to open up Zoom. What Zoom? Well, if you click on that link, it will show you. It's such a simple app, but it works so well that people don't realize how clever it is.
I struggled when I came up with this question of being able to pinpoint one particular app. I really like Jump Desktop, which allows you to remotely control and log in to other machines. That's really useful if you're out and about. But I think the winning function is yet again something that's built into the OS, which is the share sheet. I use that so much. So when I describe the share sheet, it's actually the technical term for the little square icon with an arrow at the bottom that you press every time you want to bookmark a page in Safari or you want to share a photograph to someone. But the interesting thing is that you can customize that so much more in the OS. And when you think about it, how much you use that throughout the day is quite staggering. So you'll take a photo and you'll press share sheet to send to a contact, or you'll write a note and you want to share it. There are some very little clever little interactions that people have put on there as well. So for people that use drafts, you can share to drafts. So you can make a note, or you can share a URL link directly into messages, like Tina was saying. My favorite one has to be some of the customizable ones. So it's almost like having shortcuts. So you can remove the XF data out of an image, or you can select all the text on the page and convert it to HTML or Markdown. And it's literally all these functions all in one tiny little grid. And the list goes on. I will happily share some in the show notes, the ones that I use. But I probably hit that maybe 200-300 times a day doing different things.
I think after what we said, it really is down to the use that you want to. I think, yes, it initially was a consumer-only device. You mostly used it just to look at stuff. But over the course of time, I'm used it much more. And I think it's got to a point now it can replace my MacBook Pro for 80% of the work I do.
I was just looking through my apps on the dock and how many of those are iPad or iOS apps. And it's almost all of them. This is the point of the show where we answer our listeners' tech questions. By all means, you're happy for us to be emailed in with your tech questions, or you can even leave us a voice message, which the link can be found in the show's description on all iOS or Apple Podcast apps, as well as many other third parties. Our first question today is, I wish to share a password using AirDrop. Is AirDrop safe?
We would first say that if you're on a private network, which is, say, your home network, and you're sharing it from one computer to the other, the chances are the only people on that network is yourself and anyone else in your family, so thus it would be safe. Whereas if you were using the Wi-Fi in Starbucks and you're sending it to your from your phone to your computer or to your colleague, anyone inside Starbucks could catch that signal and intercept it, is a possibility. So what we would say is, if it's on a private network, you're probably secure. But if it's on a public Wi-Fi network, no. Does AirDrop use encryption like WhatsApp, i.e. no? From what I understand, it's not at the same level. I know it has a basic form of encryption, but it's not the pre-forward encryption which WhatsApp have, which means you can't do a replay attack, because WhatsApp currently follows the Signal protocol, which is a much tougher security system. But at the moment, it's going to be tricky to answer that one completely, because Apple are quite careful at not revealing the answers.
Lots of work has been done in trying to understand how it actually communicates with other devices, and I think that's part of the breakdown in its security aspect of that. So we, as with everything, you can't be 100%. The next question is, how do I mute my Mac startup chime? And I was thinking about this when I first read it. Why would I want to do that? And to be honest, the only suggestion I come across was that maybe you're in a lecture hall and you turned up late and you didn't want the embarrassment of the machine booting up. That might be a reason why, or if you're in a recording environment, but I don't see why you'd want to do that.
So effectively, all we can think of is, A, you're in an environment which is noise sensitive. So if you turn on a noise, it would cause problems. Second one, you're in an environment which prohibits branding. So by turning the bong on, it is branding, and thus it breaks your legal requirements inside the building, which I have come across in one instance. What I would say is, it would probably be a terminal command which you would change in single user mode, which would get into the firmware, which would adjust it. But when they were coders who were changing the firmware to make the computer go bong when they didn't go bong, they found that certain operating systems would be more effective than others, and Big Sur being the most difficult. So effectively, you could change the updates and then Apple could release the firmware and it could eradicate that system. So you've got to be very careful about changing anything at a firmware level. Second of all, you don't know what you might deactivate in the process of doing so. So I would say, yes, there are stuff out there, but it's going to be tricky.
And the last question came from Ellen, and she put, I do a lot of written work on the Mac, and I often end up with multiple copies of documents, and I tend to lose track of them. Is there a way to compare them or to make sure that I have the right file? This is a bit of a tricky one. I think a lot of this comes down to whichever writing app you're using may be able to give some more detailed advice. The only two options that I could find in this, in thinking about the programs I use, is that when you write in drafts, it creates a version number and you can physically revert back to a version, or you can put them side by side so there is a form of comparison. And the only other app that I can think of that does it better or in more detail is BB Edit, and BB Edit actually has a function that's called Find Differences, and you can compare the two windows. So if you open up two text documents, it will actually highlight where the differences are.
The only thing I could think of was that you do an MD5 hash and compare the two hashes, and that will tell you if the file is identical, but that won't tell you which one is newer than the other. It just compares them to see if it's a duplicate. where in the past I would say, you know, in Finder, you have the ability to say in a spotlight search, which is the one which you see when you open up a Finder a window and on the right-hand side, that you can type into and say, I'm looking for a file with this name. And then you can say, I'm looking for date opened or date modified. So show me all files which are date modified or of this size. And then you can do a comparison. You can see, okay, this one was opened at 10:24. This one was opened at 10:25. And I can compare the difference. But there isn't a lot out there to compare. I mean, there was in Pages and Text Edit, if you go up to that little tiny triangle, you can see all the different versions, and you could go back because they're both saved in the cloud. You can see different versions of it, but that won't tell you which is the newer version, because this is a tricky thing. You can see which file is the same size. You can see which files were opened latest and newest, but it won't tell you what the contents of the document is, because you need a human to read the context. And this is now where we're getting into AI software, where it's understanding the contextual content of the text to compare the two and say, well, this one is actually newer, or this one has been checked for spelling.
I'm intrigued. That's opened a can of worms in wanting to go away and find the answer to this one. So sadly, we've come to the end of yet another episode of the Brew and Byte Show, and we'll say thank you to Martin this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys. Always nice to talk to you and talk to our listeners.
And thank you to Tina.
Night all the best. Hope you're having a good time wherever you are.
And thank you to Alistair.
It was always fun meeting up with you guys, so goodbye.
If you've enjoyed the show, we would love for you to follow or subscribe, depending on your podcast player of choice. We also love to hear your feedback. And as always, we release a new episode every other Monday. Until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.